Okay, is everybody back?
Yeah.
All right, great. So I'll start today by asking if there are any announcements.
This is Kristen, and I had sent an email out earlier yesterday, but just wanted to also make sure people that were headed to NSTA, we were trying to all meet up. And I will send something out tomorrow with a place and time. It sounds like climate stewards are meeting Saturday night, so that might be the time. There's also some discussion about vegan barbecue on Thursday night that Frank was highlighting, which is also totally anyone who's excited about that, too. So I'll put a couple things down.
Okay, great.
Is anyone on the call going on NSTA besides Frank and I?
If you could document the size of the presence there for the Clean Network, that would be nice. I know you won't be able to do that in a comprehensive way, but anything that you could provide, that would be great.
Absolutely.
Will do.
So I can let everybody know that I do have a Clean Network roundtable proposal into NAAAE. I can still edit it and add people who might want to be presenters with the group of us. It's not a formal presentation. It's more like having conversations about the Clean Network and collaborations with the people that are there. The deadline for that is the 31st. So, but it's submitted, so we can just update it at this point. The other thing that I want to remind everybody of is that we need to organize the AGU climate literacy sessions. I've started a Google Doc that where people can identify their interests and also which session proposal they'd like to be a convener on. There's a Google Doc that's accessible at the top of the Clean Network teleconference page. There's a link to the Google Doc there, and I've also sent the link out in email. So, and we will have our discussion next week will be around those session proposals. And the deadline's April 20th. Is there any other announcements?
Sure. This is Frank Niebold at NOAA. My colleague Bruce Morovcik, I don't believe he's on the line, but he sent around a note, I believe, to the network about the climate stewardship stewards workshops that are coming up, and just want to confirm that you guys saw that.
Yep.
Anybody see that?
Yes, I received that.
So, you know, participating, I mean, they're not everywhere, but they're coming up and between Long Beach and Detroit and so on. So, you know, it's a good opportunity for us to kind of collaborate at a more regional scale. So Bruce and Peg, who you guys know, would be good to connect to if you're interested in those events.
That's great. Yep.
Okay.
Bruce,
any other announcements? Oh, actually, another person, I don't think she's on the phone right now, but we should introduce you to, as many of you know, Scott is going to step down from his role at the end of May. Hopefully he won't be leaving us absolutely completely, but he will have a reduced presence. And we have engaged Johanna Boswa, who was formerly education director of the Earth Day Network and has moved on to graduate school, but in the Netherlands. But as a graduate student, she could become a ESA Federation Fellow, and ESA is Earth Science Information Partners Fellow. And in that role, she's going to be resuming some of the responsibilities that Scott has been helping with us with so ably the past number of years. Anyway, we will. So you'll be hearing more from.
I'm here. Johanna.
Oh, you're there. Hi, Johanna.
I am.
So you can say anything else about yourself then if you're on. I didn't realize you were on.
Yeah, no, just got on. It's a little bit later over here, but I'm really excited to continue to work with the Clean Network and work on climate education, climate literacy, now that I'm in school again myself. And excited to also kind of get some more a European perspective too. So I look forward to working with you all.
Great. Great. Okay, thanks. All right, any other announcements or comments? Okay, if not, we'll move. Go ahead.
I just got a quick one. I just got a note about the Polar Partnership. Looks like they have a Gains for Change Climate Challenge. Has that come across the network yet?
I think it might have, but I don't remember.
It does sound familiar.
It doesn't sound familiar? Okay, well, I'll bounce it around.
It's
$10,000 prize.
I did pass that on to somebody. Yep, I did pass that on to somebody.
All right, great.
All right, so we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Emily Schorning. She is Director of Community Organizing and Research at the National Center for Science Education in California. She has a PhD in microbiology, but has moved on to doing science education, and is going to be talking to us today about the Science Booster Club project, Building Grassroots Supports for Science Education. The slides have been posted on the website, so hopefully you have downloaded them. And so, Emily, I'll turn this over to you. Please refer to your slide numbers as you go along, just so people come in late, they can catch up.
Well, thanks very much. So the National Center for Science Education is based in California, but I'm actually based in Iowa, and that's where I'm doing work, where I'm working on this project. So as you're envisioning all of this, it's going on in the heartland. So if we go into slide number 2, we know that education is a critical part of our national response to climate change. And I think that many of us have had suspicions that kids weren't getting the best education about climate change in schools, but the National Center for Science Education just recently put out some results from a survey we did, which is the first time that the state of climate change education in K-12 environments has really been critically examined. I wanted to share just a few survey highlights. I know that Josh came and gave a talk to your network just recently, so I won't spend too much time on it. But for those of you who might have missed that talk, we'll go to slide 3, which shows us in middle school and then in 4 high school disciplines, earth science, biology, chemistry, and physics, how much time tends to be spent on climate change. And you can see that although we do have kind of a narrow tail of teachers in all of these environments spending quite a bit of time on climate change in the classroom, that on average, over the course of a year, middle and high school students receive maybe 4 or 5 hours of education on climate change, and that a significant percentage of teachers in all of these environments don't teach climate change at all. We found that about a third of American students really are not meaningfully exposed to climate change in school. And if we go over to slide 4, this gives us some idea of what is being discussed in those few hours that climate change is presented in middle and high school science classrooms. This was an interesting design approach that NCSE took with this survey. They asked teachers, amongst other things, these 2 questions. When I do teach about climate change, I emphasize the scientific consensus that recent global warming is primarily caused by human release of greenhouse gases from fossil fuels. And they also asked the question further in the survey, when I do teach climate change, I emphasize that many students believe that recent increases in temperature are likely due to natural causes. So this is a situation where if a teacher is informed about the scientific consensus on climate change, they'd agree with the first statement and they'd disagree with the second one. So by asking these 2 different questions, which you'd expect different responses from an informed audience, we're able to really get an idea of some basic knowledge present in the teaching population. And we see that just over slightly half of teachers, 54% of teachers, agree with the scientific consensus and are informed enough to disagree with the idea that many scientists believe that recent increases in temperature are due to natural causes. An additional 31% of teachers appear to have mixed messages, to have internalized mixed messages about climate change. We find that about 10% of teachers are denialists, don't deny the scientific consensus about climate change, and about 5% of teachers avoid the topic. So, you know, the news could be worse, that slightly more than half of teachers are informed and have internalized the scientific consensus for their teaching. But that leaves us with about 45% of American students who are getting some degree of at least inaccuracy, if not outright denial, related to the scientific consensus on the topic of climate change. So where I come into the picture and where my research project, the Booster Club project, comes in is trying to figure out what factors are contributing to this inadequate teaching. So if we go on to slide 5, Minda Verbecco, my colleague at NCSC and I, we did a survey that tried to look at where teachers feel supported and where they don't feel supported. And we did this in 2,000 teachers in different environments, rural and urban, various demographics in their communities. And we found that teachers actually do feel very supported by their peers and their students, but that they have, in general, a real lack of community support, that they don't feel supported by the parents of their students and that other community members, they feel like a distinct negative impression from. So we theorize that this lack of community support contributes to problems in science education. The teachers may, for example, be concerned that they're going to rock the boat if they're in an area where topics like climate change are considered socially unacceptable. So we're looking at factors that might try to help strengthen community support. And that's where we began developing the Science Booster Club project. If you'll move to slide 6, we think the Booster Club project has a lot of potential strengths for several reasons. One, that there is an unmet need. Currently, there is no national or significant regional organization that currently exists to organize communities on a grassroots level around the cause of science education. We envision the Booster Club project eventually being able to function in a manner similar to like the Girl Scouts of America, where you would have a science booster club in every community, and it would serve to bring people together around the topic of science education. And I think that there's really some need for that because there's a huge lack of awareness in the general population about problems that science teachers face right now. Most community members that I have worked with over the last nearly a year are completely unaware of the degree to which budget cuts target science education in K-12 context and are not at all aware of the degree of unmet needs in the science classroom. People don't know that the average science teacher spends hundreds of dollars out of pocket on classroom supplies every year. And I'll get back to this degree of unmet need further in the talk. Another thing that the Science Booster Club project will be able to do is address this problem of the lack of access to science education in public venues. In many communities, particularly those where science teachers might feel a particular lack of support, science only really comes up in the context of conflict. And in public settings, there are very few participatory science events. There are very few opportunities for people to engage in the scientific method and to experience science in a fun, engaging, hands-on, really destigmatizing way. So the vision for the Booster Club project, as presented in slide 7, is that through this project, we're going to have an organization that will help to normalize science, that within a community, frequent positive public science events could make science and controversial in some communities topics like climate change more accessible for your average citizen and more real, not something that happens on the news, not something that dangerous liberals in Berkeley come up with, something that's real and part of their community. We want to also use the Booster Club project as a means for local science teachers to be heard, to provide venues for local science teachers to speak and to be recognized as an important part of the community. We want to empower teachers by making there be really evident, clear local support for science and have them have a place where it's safe to ask for what they need, both basic materials for their classrooms, social support, and to help students have the ability to address standards such as those presented in NGSS without experiencing significant community pushback. We think that through a booster club type model of funding, which has been used successfully for extracurriculars like sports, marching bands, we can have a community appropriate funding model that will help to meet local teacher needs in an environment where really there are severe budget cutbacks making it difficult for school administrations to fund teacher needs. So if we move on to slide 8, I'll tell you where we are with realizing this vision right now. So we started working on the Booster Club project not very long ago. I started work with NCSE in mid-April, and I started doing organizing work for the Science Booster Club project in early May. So we've been working on this project for less than a year. In that time, we've started booster clubs in 4 communities. We began with one. Our pilot club is in Iowa City, Iowa, and we expanded in the winter to 1 mid-sized city and 2 fairly rural communities. We have 546 members as of today. Every month, we put on about 3 public events. These tend to draw fairly large crowds. Our smaller events tend to have about 150 to 250 people. Our larger events have several thousand people come. People have become very excited about these events. I have lost track of how many hundreds of volunteer hours have gone into putting on these community science events. We have had, over this less than a year, thousands of event participants, and people are coming to the events in larger and larger numbers, and we've been booking larger and larger venues. Of our 5,300 event participants so far, about 3,000 of those, maybe a bit more than 3,000 of those, have been in the new year, have been in the last 3 months. We've been able to raise significant amounts of money at these events from the community, and we've received grants from local STEM businesses, such as Rockwell Collins has been a generous supporter of the aerospace company. And from that, we've managed to distribute grants to 7 area teachers, purchasing physical equipment, durable equipment, that until the kids break it, because they will break it at some point, will impact about 1,400 students in the region a year. So in less than a year, we've really had the significant success, I think, at presenting, normalizing, exciting context for science education in a community setting. And communities have been very responsive. If we move on to slide 9, I can share some of our program highlights with you so you can get an idea of what sort of activities we've been doing with the Booster Club project. You can see one of our volunteers here in the top left corner looking into a very large telescope. One of our more successful fundraisers was at a local observatory where we were able to raise a significant amount of money by letting people look in giant telescopes and drink wine. This was not one of our more socially controversial science programs. The rest of these, which you can't necessarily tell, but all dealt with either evolution and or climate change. You can see that people are engaged at these events, learning about evolution and or climate change. Even though these are, in fact, socially contentious topics in this community where we've been running the club. We have put on exhibits connecting historical changes in the Earth's climate with significant extinction, such as was involved with Ice Age megafauna. We've put on events talking about serious threats to our current way of life, related to climate change, such as exhibit on sea level rise, which we can see a zombie constructing a young Egyptian about that. That was a nice Halloween event to talk about some of the more catastrophic implications of climate change. We do stuff to get people outside. We do nature hikes where we look at when we can find flowering plants and when we experience first and last frost, so that we can connect that to information related to climate change. And, you know, we know that in several states, such as in, I think North Dakota has 9 more frost-free days. So people are able to make really concrete connections in their communities with climate change that's happening now, and this helps them to speculate about what the reality of this situation will be in 50 years. We do things to engage very young children as well as adults, such as planting seeds and talking about what sort of things plants need to live and how the changing climate can affect these basic factors. And we help people use scientific equipment. And that last picture in the bottom right corner, you can sort of see on the edge of the picture that there's a greenhouse there. And that was a fun experience. That was the greenhouse experience event where we would let people go in a greenhouse. And we had gas probes in there so that people could see that CO2 levels changed the more people you packed into the greenhouse. I think that for a lot of people, even educated adults, this concept of CO2 as a gas is confusing to them. I think that for many people, the idea of a colorless, odorless gas, that's very abstract. And doing anything we can to show that that is something that's actually measurable, that it's not something that scientists make up, giving people the hands-on chance to work with scientific equipment appears to really engage them and open people's minds to the possibility that the scientific consensus reflects some sort of accurate, actual information. So we've had a lot of fun. We've been able to draw a lot of big crowds. And if we'll go on to slide 10, I wanted to talk with you about some unexpected findings from working with the public on climate change in this the sort of friendly Midwestern setting where, you know, Iowa is a state with a lot of political variability. We find people with a lot of different viewpoints. And although we do certainly have a lot of people in Iowa who are very accepting of the scientific consensus of climate change, we also have a fair amount of climate denial. So you run into a nice mixed population at these events here. And I found that the community response to this sort of public climate change education really varies by topic. I wanted to talk with you in a little bit of detail about 3 of the activities that we've done with the booster clubs. These are activity about sea level rise called Eyes on the Rise, a activity connecting climate change and species extinction, an activity about ocean acidification. The main thread that has emerged from doing various types of climate change education with the general public is that the less informed people are about a topic before they encounter the exhibit, the less pushback occurs. So the less people know about it before they come in, the less negative comments that we get, the greater level of engagement we get. It's rather interesting. Let's talk about that in some more detail. We go to slide 11. First one I'm going to talk about is our sea level rise exhibit. So this is an exhibit that we've done with a fairly large population, about 1,200 total children and adults. To explore the topic of sea level rise, we had a brief video that we let people watch that would show how the Earth's coastlines would change in a worst-case situation with sea level rise, which was a very visually dramatic, very frightening video. And we had a super simple hands-on activity where, with various glass jars, we would paste the cityscapes of coastal cities like Miami that are going to be very affected by sea level rise, or we would paste pictures of cultural icons that are going to be affected by sea level rise, like the Easter Island statues. And we would have kids, including very young children, pour water in to show how much and to where the cities or monuments would be impacted by sea level rise. So this was a very concrete way of making the phenomena real to people. It was very simple. It was very low cost. And while volunteers were guiding people through these activities, we tried to have some members of our team kind of hang back and watch how people reacted to these activities. So I had thought that most people would have heard of sea level rise. But in fact, less than 20% of the people at this event had heard of these phenomena. We had a couple of out-of-town visitors who identified themselves who were from coastal Louisiana and Florida who were extremely happy to see that people were doing a public activity about sea level rise and who told others in the audience and told our volunteers stories of how they're personally experiencing sea level rise, that they're having to rebuild docks, that this is really a phenomena that is quite evident to people who live in threatened regions. More than 70% of people, including those who had heard of it and those who hadn't, had a positive response to the activity. We had three people register complaints about the events, which obviously that's a tiny fraction of the 1,200 people. And they tended to say that their theme was that this was not appropriate information to discuss in public, that this was too controversial of information to discuss in public. I think this sort of pushback tends to have an outsized impact on programs. I think that especially in states where there's a culture of niceness, where people don't want to make waves, where they don't want to cause conflict, I could see something like three complaints shutting down a program that has a 70% positive response. But when we find that less than 20% of participants in a crowd like this had even heard of the phenomena of climate change-related sea level rise, it makes it seem very clear, to me at least, that we need to push forward with education on this issue. Related to this complaint, about 15% of participants who went through this activity engaged in active denial behaviors, and that you could see that people were upset to a great degree that they did not want to take the information in. I saw grown adults do things like put their hands over their eyes so that they didn't have to watch the video. People were obviously, small numbers of people were obviously very upset by this exhibit. Moving on to slide 12, we had another exhibit on species extinction. We've had a slightly smaller population run through this one. We've had about 800 people run through this one. For this, we had a hands-on activity where we had fossils of ice age animals and pictures of what the organisms looked like when they were alive, and we had people kind of match these up. And we had a poster display where we looked at how the temperature changed around the time where these ice age animals became extinct, and we had additional figures about how the climate is projected to change and has been shown to change now. And if people looked at the poster display, they would see that there is some evidence that the extinction of ice age animals was not purely due to climate change, that there is the unfortunate pile of evidence that mostly we ate the American megafauna, which is sad because they're pretty cool. I wish we hadn't eaten them all. The reaction breakdown to this exhibit, though, was really interesting. This is the activity where most people had heard of it. More than 60% of people had heard of the phenomena that species extinctions have been linked to climate change and that we anticipate more and more species to go extinct if climate change continues at anticipated levels. About 50% of participants had a positive response to the exhibit, but many more people than in the sea level rise had a negative response. We saw a similar level of people engaged in sort of active denial behaviors, hostile behaviors, putting their hands over their eyes, making complaints. But a larger percentage of the audience, maybe 30% of the audience, exhibited a lot of disengagement. They had heard of it. They didn't want to learn any more about it. It was extremely difficult to get people's attention to keep them engaged with this exhibit. And then we move on to slide 13. But you know, we were surprised that people were so disengaged with the species extinction because we had really cool fossils. We figured people would want to touch them, would want to look at them. But no, people did not. They felt like their minds were made up, was the impression we got, that people had had enough information on species extinction. Moving on to ocean acidification. This is an activity that we've just started developing. We've run it through about 1,000 participants. We have a hands-on activity with this one and a poster display, both focusing on how CO2 relates to ocean acidification. So in the poster, we have different graphs showing how the Earth's ocean has become more acidic since about 1850. And we do two hands-on activities. One of them is really effective. We have people blow into a cup with about 100 mils of water in it with a pH strip in it. And people can see that as they blow into the cup and blow CO2 through the water, that the pH of the water changes pretty dramatically. It goes from, you know, about 7 to about 5 over the course of a couple of minutes. Both kids and adults like this activity. Kids especially like it because they're able to blow bubbles into a cup. They're usually not allowed to do that. We also have a related exhibit where people can see shells, like mussel shells, you know, from food shellfish. And we put acidic solution on them made out of vinegar, and people can see that the shells are bubbling. People can see the shelled animals dissolve in mildly acidic environments. So the reaction breakdown to this phenomena has, again, been very unexpected. I thought that some people would have heard of ocean acidification. Maybe not so many, because I don't hear it in the news very often. But, in fact, less than 5% of our participants had heard of the phenomena of ocean acidification. And this includes many teachers. We had many teachers come to one of the events where we did this. And none of the teachers, none of the K-12 teachers, had heard about ocean acidification. The response to this exhibit was extremely positive. People who were skeptical about climate change engaged with the display. People who were skeptical about climate change did the hands-on activity, saw for themselves the CO2 caused this change in pH. And I saw a lot of people have really interesting reactions of curiosity, reactions of wanting to know more. This is the first climate change education event we've done where we haven't had any complaints from people, even though the phenomena is pretty terrifying. If you think about a potential future where the Earth's oceans become too acidic to support the life of most shelled organisms, that's an enormous extinction event. That's terrifying. But people didn't have a negative response to it. People didn't want us to stop educating about that. I think that's very interesting. So if we move on to slide 14, that has given me some preliminary conclusions to take away. And the first is that it may be valuable in public climate change education to really try and focus on areas that have not been heavily addressed by denialist outlets. I think another thing that's useful is to focus on topics that allow for hands-on data collection, even if it's very primitive, like this cup of water and pH strip thing. If people are able to feel like they're somehow measuring CO2, if they're able to somehow perceive these fairly abstract concepts related to colorless, odorless gases, I think that can be very useful for engaging people who are sort of casually skeptical about science and specifically about the scientific consensus on climate change. I know that a lot of previous research on climate change education has focused a lot on how important it is to present positivity with information about climate change, to convey accurate information about what's going on, but to bundle that with sort of what you can do, what people can do to help reduce the impact of climate change, can do to reduce CO2 impact. And, you know, we've tried to have a lot of this sort of what you can do literature and to include this in our presentation. And I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But just anecdotally, from my experience with the Booster Club project, it seems like this positivity factor may not be as important as the novelty factor, that getting to topics before people have had time to set up a lot of misconceptions on those topics may be unexplored and extremely important aspect of public climate change education. And I really have to recommend for any of you who are doing any sort of public engagement, public outreach work, this ocean acidification thing, at least here, has proved an unexpectedly rich topic. It is really easy to bring in live animals that are going to be affected by this. You know, people love it when you have live animals. We were talking about how we were going to run this exhibit again at a time where we might not be able to get sort of leftover biology lab animals from our university partner. It was like, well, obviously we'll go to the grocery store. We'll get some live clams. We'll get some live mussels. If we feel this is extravagant, we can bring in a lobster. And people are excited when they see live animals. They don't care if it's a live animal you can buy in a grocery store. It's also really easy to show that CO2 lowers pH and lowers it in a pretty dramatic way. These are supplies that you can buy commercially at a very low cost. To do that bubbling cup thing, it is significantly less than a quarter a person. To demonstrate to a person in a very clear, straightforward, and convincing way that carbon dioxide lowers the pH of water, that it acidifies water. So I said towards the beginning of the talk, if you'll transition to slide 15, that I wanted to talk just a little bit about teacher grants and about the information that the Science Booster Club Project has collected about teachers. So I've done two funding cycles now. The second one was a micro-grant cycle so that I could try and get more people to apply and give out a little less money to each teacher. Whether I'm offering funding up to a limit of $800, as in the first cycle, or up to $300, as in the second cycle, the funding requests that I get from teachers are unbelievably basic. Teachers want things like safety goggles. They want things like tables for their classroom. I funded a request last fall for wood. Teacher needed like $50 worth of wood so that their students could build some of their designs in their STEM class. Teachers are not able to get these basic, inexpensive, sometimes safety-based needs met by administration. One of the teachers that we funded in our March microgrant cycle wrote me that the students in her classroom, she teaches AP biology to hundreds of students, had to share one pair of goggles across every three students. And the administration wouldn't give her $200 to buy enough goggles for all of her students to have goggles in lab. You know, it's people are completely unaware that these are the conditions under which we expect teachers to do a great job teaching comprehensive climate change. I think that the micro-grant funding opportunities that the Booster Club is providing are not only an important source of assistance and support for teachers, they're an important source of information for the rest of us. As I've been able to get these stories out to people in the community, as you might imagine, it has made people mad. It makes me mad. You can tell it's making me mad even to talk about it. I think that if we can get people upset about this, hopefully it can be an engine for change in community to think about what we're funding in the public school system and what we should be funding in the public school system. So if we'll go on to slide 16, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the next steps for the Booster Club, starting with the spring and the summer. So we've been really stepping up our audience size, stepping up our amount of community members engaged in Booster Club events, and throughout the spring and the summer, we have some very large events coming up. We have some big Earth Day events coming up with audiences around 2 to 3K. We are going to be exhibiting at some county fairs. Those have a 4 to 5K attendance. And we're hoping to go to the Iowa State Fair. We have our application in right now. Be there for a day, hopefully interact with 10 to 15,000 people. We're planning on exhibit about evolution at the State Fair. If we can get additional funding, we'll talk about climate change too. I think that this is going to be pretty exciting because it'll allow access to unusually diverse audiences. the county and state fairs, particularly in Iowa, are very popular. You get really high percentage of the population turning out to that, higher than your percentage of the population that votes, for example. People who are unlikely to be encountering a lot of continuing or adult education in other contexts. So getting a chance to meet, work with these people and hear their stories, that's exciting enough as it is. But with the Booster Club project, through the National Center for Science Education and the University of Iowa, we also get a chance to collect some data on these rare populations and see what their perceptions are related to scientific topics and check out their level of science literacy. Very excited about what we're going to be doing in the near future. With events that we currently have on the calendar through August, I think we're going to get another 20,000 to 25,000 people in the region exposed to climate change education and education about evolution. In the fall and the winter of this year, of 2016, as you see on slide 17, we're going to be doing a statewide expansion. So right now, you can see that with the red and blue stars, we're kind of clustered in eastern Iowa, and we're getting a pretty decent reach across eastern Iowa, but we haven't worked much up in the north, and we haven't gone west of Des Moines at all. We're starting to make some contacts in Des Moines, which is right in the center of the state. The places that we have targeted for expansion, marked with green stars, have a wide range of population sizes that include some of the larger cities in the state as well as some fairly small areas. And they're both very politically diverse and very socially diverse. So we're hoping that with the statewide expansion in fall of 2016, that we'll be ready for a national rollout maybe in 2017. If you move on to slide 18, we really think that Iowa field testing, doing all this pilot work in Iowa, is going to make a good model for national expansion. Because in Iowa, you have a tremendous amount of political and social diversity. Although Iowa is majority white, it's not in fact entirely composed of white people. It's only like 92% white. But what's going on inside of people's heads in Iowa can be very different. There's tremendous religious diversity in Iowa. There's tremendous political diversity in Iowa. And this tends to be clustered in communities. So if we can find a program that works for people from all these different educational backgrounds, all these different belief structures, all these different community structures, I think that that will be useful for communities across the nation. As we get ready for a national rollout, we're going to need to build a fully tested, standardized field manual of activities for people to put on. And we're working on building and refining these activities for public science education. We're going to need to have a nice online infrastructure to help people organize and communicate with each other. We're going to need to have a nice financial infrastructure, because I think the teacher grant aspect of the Science Booster Club project is very important. Right now, you know, the National Center for Science Education is a 501c3, so we're able to take people's donations and give them back out in the form of grants without taking any overhead. But unless we can find a way to either extend our nonprofit umbrella to these various small clubs or give people a simple way to apply for 501c3 status themselves, you have a lot of tax issues where you want ideally to be turning 100% of donations into teacher grants. Ideally, for a national rollout, we would also really be able to use some additional funding, hire staff to contribute to community organizing in various regions. So as we move on to the last slide, slide 19, I have some questions for you. I want to know if anyone has some ideas about helping me develop more funding models or ideas about places where I should apply for national type rollout funding. And perhaps even more importantly, I was wondering if any of you can think of other climate change angles that are rarely discussed in outlets where science denial is common. What are some other topics in climate change, like the ocean acidification, that maybe people don't know a lot about, so that I can start to build some activities around that and we can get that information to people before they have the chance to be misinformed? So please fill me in. Let me know if you have any ideas on these questions, and ask me some questions if you have any.
Well, thank you very much, Emily. I have one. I don't know the connection between climate change and health. I don't know the extent to which there are denialists there, but it's something that's really engaging for people.
Climate change and health. Do you have any experience with this? Have you found any topics that are particularly engaging?
Well, actually, I'll probably learn more. There's going to be a report released by the White House on Monday, I believe, on climate change and health. The one area that I was not involved at all, but the connection between environmental changes and asthma cases has been researched to some extent. I don't know the details of it, though.
Well, that is something where people are informed about it and, you know, has a disproportionate impact on children, which is always good for getting people engaged in a public context. Cool. I'll look into that. You say there's a new report coming on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll forward the information about the report on. I'm not sure if it's been released yet, but there's a White House event on Monday in which the authors are going to be giving a talk and involved in conversations. I'll be attending that event, so I'll know more about it then. But the information I'll send on about what the report is.
I appreciate that. That sounds like it could be really interesting. And I don't know that I've ever heard any like denialist type information on that front. So cool.
There's also some work in the area of psychology too, climate change and psychology. And again, I don't know the details of that, but it might be another area to explore.
Emily, this is Scott. I just want to build on what Tamara just suggested. There may be some potential for looking at sort of the onset of hay fever or allergy season. I mean, I'm allergic to trees, so I really notice it. And just recognizing that it happens earlier and earlier in the spring for those of us who are allergic to, cottonwoods and that kind of stuff, alders. And that may be something that also could be discussed with folks as they notice within themselves or with their children as allergy symptoms start happening earlier and earlier in the year.
That's a wonderful topic for us to bring up at these nature hikes we're going to do.
Exactly. And recognizing that we're seeing, the whole times that trees and certainly other plants are blooming are changing year by year, and that certainly gets back to the core piece of all of this in terms of the change in climate and the change in the onset of these of bugs and such. And I think the other part of it, of course, and that's why health is so important in discussing this, is that it's so personal and that people understand that in terms of their relationship to themselves. And so that's really why it's a very powerful way of getting people engaged. So that would be interesting to do that. And maybe even, to the point where people are starting to become self-aware of that. I'm starting to think activities here, but just so that they, when did you see the symptoms start, and is that different than last year, and do you want to keep a journal on it, or, whatever.
Well, if we're able to develop the kind of online infrastructure that I envision for a national rollout, which would help communities to communicate with each other, I think that would be a really interesting way to have people track these sort of seasonal events.
Exactly.
We have information about frost tree days. We have information about when certain species of plants bloom.
Exactly.
But just to have citizens have another area where they can contribute information about climate change to a nationally available database, I think that could be really powerful in building support and awareness.
And there are projects, Bud Burst, I think, is one of them that tracks all of that kind of stuff. So this could be some interesting partnerships with existing programs.
Yeah.
About the National Climate Assessment and their ongoing effort to try to identify ways of bringing in ongoing new information.
Mm-hmm. That'd be good.
Emily, so I'm wondering, I think it's very interesting that people were not that aware of ocean acidification. And I am wondering if you would get a very different response from people who live near the coastlines. I would guess they are much more aware of ocean acidification than the heartland is. So mm-hmm. you may find that some activities are better for that heartland area, and some may be more meaningful for those who live near the coast.
Oh, I'm sure it's the case. I mean, a lot of our activities incorporate some sort of agricultural angle that people mm-hmm. are very familiar with, and they can connect with that right off the bat. Where in coastal Florida, they might not be as familiar with corn germination. And you know what's interesting is that we always have some people in and around here from out of town when we do stuff near Iowa City, because it's a university town, so we have a big shifting population, a big temporary population. And so we always have a few people in from coastal states, like with the sea level rise, where I had people speak up because they were so happy we were talking about this topic that affects them. But our numbers for ocean acidification are pretty big. You know, we've had 1,000 people go through it, which I have to assume includes some visitors, and we haven't had anyone talk about how this has a personal impact on them. So I don't disagree. I was just really shocked by the degree to which people had simply not heard of the phenomena.
Yeah, yeah.
Far fewer than had heard of sea level rise.
This is Frank at NOAA. A quick question about the space. One of the things I'd wonder about is, especially with ocean acidification, the amount of carbon reduction to in the atmosphere to address ocean acidification concerns is actually greater than a lot of the climate targets, meaning that we would have to remove more carbon from our global economy faster. Not many people
yeah.
talk about that kind of stuff, but one of the things that came out about a year and a half ago was a study on solution aversion, and that the ideology and motivated disbelief kind of connect on this, and that depending on that, a lot of the pushback or the covering of the eyes, the look away, it's a contaminated sample we're working with because of a lot of the techniques that have been used to confuse people. But it's also the aversion to the solutions that they fear more, and that kind of motivates them to look away from the problem. Not that they don't want to look at the problem, no, they fear the solution that comes with the problem more than the problem itself. So they came out of Duke. I think other people have been building on that, but I think this idea of motivated disbelief is, I know Lynn Sherry talks about this as well, but I would be interested to, given that Iowa is such rich with other forms of energy that are not fossil fuel rich, does that conversation, whether connected to ocean acidification or to carbon reduction, show up at all in these public venues?
I think that one thing that has helped us to get these large audiences is that many people are aware, increasingly aware of, you know, the effect that wind power has had on the local economy. Many of the companies that are supplying wind power in Iowa are based in the eastern Iowa region where we're working. I definitely think that if people see some of the positive economic benefits of the green industry, that they're more open to receiving education on these topics. But,
good.
You know, what you're talking about, it is a big problem, and there isn't an easy solution to this, but hopefully we can get people to know about the problem and care about it before they have to deal with the solution.
I actually wondered about that exact point. Some studies, like the Ocean Project, have actually inverted that you normalize the solution before you really dig deep into the problem, especially with adults. And it's an interesting model that if you can live a solution that meets your values and your economics, it's much easier to accept the problem. That's more of an adult, you know, public engagement model than, you know, traditional educational model.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just a thought.
No, it's interesting. I'll look into that. If you wouldn't mind emailing me related to that.
Sure, I'll
it's a little bit hard for me to hear you.
Thank you. I got a little echoey there, so sorry about that. I'll send you the blog that Doug Myers at the Ocean Project has done on this, and then also, obviously, the solution version one. I'll send that out to the list now.
That's great.
That'd be great.
Thank you, Frank.
Emily, Scott, just a slightly different tack before we wrap this hour. I'm curious about your partnerships with informal education. This seems like something that many of those organizations would normally be doing. Are you kind of working with those groups in Iowa, and is that sort of the national model, is to somehow connect up with those networks of folks in the informal science center area?
You know, we're getting new partners all the time, but we haven't yet connected with any national networks that do informal education, and I would certainly be excited to do so if you could help point me in the right direction.
Yeah, this is
a very new project. I mean, we've been working for less than a year, but we're always trying to make new connections.
Well, there definitely is a group that that works with climate change education. It's one of the projects that was funded by NSF. And you should probably connect up with them. And that's a national program, so it would fit in with the rollout nationally.
Yeah, that's the NOPI program. That's the National Network for Ocean Interpreters. And we could connect you with Billy Spitzer. He's the lead on that project.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah. It's just a really natural partnership there.
Oh, I would really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So are there any other questions for Emily? Well, if not, we will end our conversation today. We will have our conversation next week will revolve around the climate literacy sessions for AGU and trying to get that effort to move forward. So thanks, everybody, for calling in, and thanks very much for Emily for your presentation today.
Really,
well, thanks for having me. Thanks for the help.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, all.
Tamara, shall we? Are you still there?
Sorry.
It's fixed. Yeah, I think. Yeah. No. Oh,